Welcome to Radio Times. I'm Mike and Scott in for Marty Moscowane. Pennsylvania's new and stricter Megan's Law took effect in December, making the Commonwealth the 16th state to comply with the federal Adam Walsh Child Protection and Safety Act. The act requires all states to use uniform criteria for their sexual offender registries, and it imposes a financial penalty if they fail to do so. Pennsylvania's revised law extends the length of time some sexual offenders remain on the registry and broadens the list of crimes for which people must register. It also expands the registry to include juveniles. Critics say the law is too harsh and makes it more difficult for convicted sex offenders to earn a living and get treatment. Proponents say it closes dangerous loopholes and makes it easier to track offenders across state lines. Joining us to explain Pennsylvania's new Megan's Law is Captain Scott Price of the Pennsylvania State Police. They are authorized to create and maintain Pennsylvania's sex offender registry. Captain Price, thank you so much for joining us on Radio Times. Right, he'll be there in 1 second. And we'll also talk about the pros and cons of the law with Ted Glackman of the Joseph J. Peters Institute and Greg Rowe of the Philadelphia District Attorney's Office. Thank you both for being here as well. And I want to start, Captain Scott Price, are you with us?
Yes, ma'am, I am.
All right, good morning, and thank you so much for joining us on Radio Times. I wanted to start with you. What are the biggest changes with this new, stricter law?
Well, there are a number of actually fairly significant changes. In terms of impact on the entities that manage the law, such as it were, the new law actually has a tiering system, which requires offenders to be placed into a particular tier, tier 1, 2, or 3, depending upon the offense that was committed. This is vastly different than the system had been previously. And one of the significant aspects of that particular tiering system is the fact that, you know, previously, if an offender was required to register for life, only those offenders that were classified as sexually violent predators had to require for life or had to register for life. And concomitant with the lifetime registration was a requirement to report quarterly for updates and for verifications. Under the new tiering scheme, what we see is Tier 3 offenders are required to report for life as well as being required to report quarterly. And interestingly, the impact that has had is 80% of our database, we estimate, will be Tier 3 offenders. So what we've seen as one significant impact is the fact that there are approximately 13,000 to 14,000 people in the database right now. Previously, we had about 500 to 600 people reporting for life on a quarterly basis. That will increase to potentially 9 or 10,000 people who will now be required to report for life and on a quarterly basis.
And let me ask you, who is in Tier 3?
Well, the Tier 3 offenders, and again, it's based upon the nature of the criminal act. Obviously, the Tier 3 offenders are the most serious offenders. Their offenses such as kidnapping, rape, statutory sexual assault, certain subsections, involuntary deviant sexual intercourse, what we refer to as IDSI, the most serious offenders would be classified as Tier 3. And so, as I said, that's in actuality, we had estimated 80% of our database would be Tier 3. I'm seeing about 76% based on our current numbers right now.
And is this law retroactive across the board? So does that mean you might also have to track down some offenders who did not have to register right now because it's too long ago?
Well, retroactivity is an interesting question. When the law was originally passed last December, there were some provisions that were deemed retroactive. There were some amendments to the Act. It was Act 111, and then amendments became Act 75, which essentially removed some of the retroactive provisions. Having said that, however, there still are some offenses which heretofore hadn't been captured or didn't require registration, among them, for instance, corrupting the morals of a minor. What has happened in the way the law is structured, if individuals were on supervision, i.e. were reporting to probation, parole, or if individuals were incarcerated on those predicate offenses, such as corrupting the morals of a minor, they wouldn't have had to register necessarily under the previous version of the law, but they now do. So in that sense, if those individuals were on supervision on December 20th, they now have to register. So I hesitate to deem it retroactivity, because within the confines of the law, there were some different retroactivity provisions that we referred to as a felony look back. It's not that I'm referring to, but it's this capturing of offenses that didn't previously require registration.
Yeah, but it sounds like you have been very busy just trying to update the current database and see who else might go into the database now.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, our partners throughout the criminal justice system, whether it be Department of Corrections, Pennsylvania Board of Probation and Parole, or our partners at the county levels, the local probation and parole agencies, there are significant, significant responsibilities placed on all those entities. So the breadth and scope of the law has increased the responsibilities on a number of agencies.
And tell me about the other two tiers. So we heard that Tier 3 are the most serious offenders, will register for a lifetime. What's Tier 2?
Right. When you get into Tier 2, and again, this is all specifically delineated by offense, if you will. As an example, Tier 2 offenses also might include some sections of statutory sexual assault, prostitution, certain sections of prostitution and related offenses, some sections of obscene or sexual materials. And some federal offenses are included in each category as well, and Tier 2 offenders would require a 25-year reporting period, and rather than reporting quarterly as a Tier 3 offender would, a Tier 2 offender reports twice per year. And then moving down the scale, if you will, that we have the Tier 1 offenders. And this is where we see it's been referred to at various points that some offenses that weren't sexual in nature and did not previously require registration come in this category, if you will.
And, like what? Can you give an example?
Well, I would say, for instance, unlawful restraint, which is 2902 of the Crimes Code, or false imprisonment. They're not per se sexual offenses, although very often they have a sexual component associated with them. So those offenses came in under Tier 1, and Tier 1 offenders now have to register for 15 years and basically appear annually for verifications.
And generally speaking, how does the registration happen? When does it happen? Who takes care of it? Who monitors it?
The registration now, we refer to it as being front-loaded in the sense that the probation agency of the appropriate county, of the sentencing county, is responsible to register an offender at the time of sentencing. Now, obviously, there are some persons in correctional facilities or some persons incarcerated because the law previously did not require registration at time of sentencing that aren't currently registered, and they'll be captured prior to release to the street. But currently, under the current law, it'll be accomplished by our partners at the county probation and parole agencies.
We're talking about sex offender registries, and right now we're chatting with Captain Scott Price of the Pennsylvania State Police. And I also wanted to ask you, I looked yesterday at the Megan's Law site and registry here in Pennsylvania. Seemed like there were about 200 people, offenders, who were not compliant or had absconded. So what happens to them? How do you enforce this?
Well, what'll happen, and we actually had a significant date this week, coincidentally. March 20th was the expiration of the 90 days since enactment, and all current offenders, all offenders who were in the database had to come in within the first 90 days and update information. So as we vet through those, what will happen is when we identify an offender who hasn't met reporting requirements through We've developed a new computer database, an electronic database called PA Sort, which is the sexual offender registration tool. We'll identify those offenders who have not met their reporting requirements, and then letters will be generated, what we refer to as an investigation letter, and sent to the appropriate investigatory agency. It may be a state police facility if we have jurisdiction, or it may be a municipal police department if the offender's last known address was within a municipal police jurisdiction.
And also in Philadelphia, I saw there were about 2,000 people on the list. How do you expect it to expand going forward when people are being released who have to register now, who didn't have to register before?
We had initially, I know Philadelphia had about 2,183, I believe, who were residents. There were actually another 785 people registered in Philadelphia, Philadelphia City, Philadelphia County, as being employed there, and another 76 who were students. So actually in the Philadelphia area, there are about 3,000 registered offenders, 3,044 exactly, as of yesterday. We anticipated from the beginning that in the past we had seen an uptick of about 1,000 to 1,500 new registrants a year. The database grew. We expect that it will grow more than that. We're looking at some initial numbers and trying to project, but what we see is potentially a 35% increase in the database. Not necessarily in the database, in the total number of transactions, which would be verification transactions as well as new registrations.
And in your opinion, what are the biggest benefits of this new legislation?
Well, in for us, in terms of managing the registry, of course, development of PA Sort, I think ultimately will be a significant benefit because it will streamline the process. We'll be getting rid of paper registrations, and so it will streamline the process. In addition, it allowed us to make some enhancements to the website. For example, an individual can go into our Megan's Law website, which is PA Megan's Law at state.pa.us, and can actually set up, if you will, boundaries. You can enter a particular address and get email notifications if an offender moves out of that particular area. So from our perspective, there have been some significant enhancements to the process and to our procedures that you know we maintain as the repository, if you will.
And the uniformity of it, before we get to break, is that also helpful, that it will be similar from state to state now?
Well, uniformity is important, and eventually, as we enhance our PA Sort system, we believe that will be a benefit. Having said that, obviously, you had said in the intro, there are 16 states that are SORNA compliant. So that doesn't necessarily mean that the 16 states meet every SORNA requirement, but the SMART office, right, the Sexual Offender Monitoring Office, deems us substantially compliant.
Okay,
so yes,
with that,
there is
greater
consistency.
Okay, thank you so much, Captain Scott Price with the Pennsylvania State Police. We'll talk more about sex offender registries here on Radio Times after a short break. Stay with us.
The Philadelphia Speaker Series, presented by Widener University, announces its 2013-14 season at the Kimmel Center. Seven engaging evenings with Apple co-founder Steve Wozniak, author Bill Bryson, former Greek Prime Minister George Papandreou, former Secretary of Defense Robert Gates, poet laureate Billy Collins, Ambassador John Huntsman, and historian Doris Kearns Goodwin. PhiladelphiaSpeakerSeries.org, sponsored by WHYY.
I'm Jesse Thorne. This week on Bullseye, I talked to the writer Simon Rich about that special time in middle school when the girls have their growth spurt before all the guys.
Yeah, I remember that. It was like a conspiracy coming back to school in seventh grade. And like, wow, everybody is in on this?
Simon Rich, author of The Last Girlfriend on Earth and other love stories, on the next Bullseye from PRI.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
Phoebe Ministries supports WHYY with communities in Lehigh, Berks, Bucks, and Montgomery counties. Phoebe specializes in healthcare, housing, and services for senior adults. April 10th, the Phoebe Institute on Aging presents An Interfaith View of the Spiritual Aspects of Aging and Dying. featuring Rabbi Dale Friedman and leaders of multiple faith traditions. The conference provides spiritual leaders, healthcare, and human services professionals the opportunity to learn about the aging process across cultures. Details at phoebe.org/PIA.
And welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mike and Scott in for Marty Moskowain. We're talking about sex offender registries. And before our break, we spoke with Captain Scott Price of the Pennsylvania State Police about Pennsylvania's new and stricter version of the Megan's Law. And now we're going to do some analysis and understand the thinking behind these laws and how they affect people. Joining us in studio is Ted Glackman. He is Executive Director of the Joseph J. Peters Institute. It's a nonprofit mental health agency, and they provide treatment services for people who have experienced sexual abuse, and also they counsel offenders. Ted Glackman, thank you so much for being here.
Very nice to be here.
And also joining us in the studio is Greg Rowe. He's chief of the Legislation and Policy Unit for the Philadelphia District Attorney's Office. Thank you so much for being here.
Good morning, and thank you.
And Greg, let's start with you. What is the thinking behind these registries? Some states had registries as early as 1947. Nationwide, we've seen these laws since the mid-90s, roughly.
Right, and that's exactly right. We've seen the bulk of the registries begin in the mid-90s after the initial Megan's Law was passed by Congress and imposed on the states the requirement that they establish sex offender registries. The thinking is this, is that parents and others ought to know if there's a sex offender living near them, near their child, or working near their child, so they can be equipped in order to address that situation, because there are certain recidivism rates among certain sex offenders that are of concern, and there are tools that parents and others can employ in order to ensure that their child or that they are not a victim. It is not, nor should it be, considered the tool or the resource. Rather, it is a resource and a tool among many others to provide the protection and the notice to Pennsylvanians.
Now, when we think of these registries, we do think children. We think offenders who have hurt children. Do we know anything of the percentage of the people on the list who actually have offended against children as opposed to against adults? And what was the thinking in including all sex offenders?
I don't know the breakdown between the age of the victims among those who are on the registry. But when you look at a lot of these crimes, particularly in the lower tiers, they are specifically about when the victims are minors. Now, rape can be rape of a 5-year-old, it can be rape of a 2-year-old, it can be rape of a 70-year-old. The thinking about it is that, number one, there is a high recidivism rate among sex offenders. Now, most sex offenses aren't reported. Perhaps 80% or more of rapes and other sexual assaults are not reported. So what we're dealing with in terms of who's on the registry are a vast minority of sexual offenders, because unfortunately people don't report sex crimes for very obvious and understandable reasons. So the goal here was both sex offenders of children and of adults. What brought us to this was originally the Megan Kanka case in New Jersey in the early 90s. She obviously was a child. And finally, the goal here is we as parents and others have a duty to protect our children. We can take steps to protect ourselves, but we need to take steps to protect others, the most vulnerable, and those are the kids.
Ted Glackman, let me turn to you. What do we know about recidivism rates among sex offenders?
Well, Greg makes a good point that that the majority of offenses are not reported, and we don't really know what that is or what that means. But what we do know from studies of rearrest rates, the recidivism is actually considerably lower than the public would believe from media accounts of the worst crimes. Large meta-analytic studies put it at about 15% overall. Recent studies from the New Jersey Department of Corrections in New York put it at about 5% over a three-year period post-conviction. So there's a lot of debate, and there's a lot of meaningful debate about what all this means. And the one area we don't know, we don't know what doesn't get reported, and we don't know what that means about recidivism rate. But when we look at the research and the statistics that we actually have access to, recidivism is quite a bit lower than the public believes.
Now, do we assume pathology with sex offenders and especially with those who offend against children? We talk about treatment. We don't often talk about that with other offenders. So what's our thinking in terms of why these people offend?
Well, I don't think we should assume a mental illness or pathology necessarily. I was recently reading Michael Kimmel's book, Guyland. He's a sociologist from NYU, talking about the pervasive culture on college campuses and the sexual misbehavior, some of it leaning towards chargeable crimes that is seemingly more and more common on college campuses. So there are a lot of complicated factors that go into an eventual conviction of a sexual offense.
Who do you treat? You treat sex offenders. So who are the people and what's going on with them?
We treat the individuals who've gone through the legal process. A crime has been reported. It's been adjudicated. Often the individual's been incarcerated or is on parole. And we treat them as part of their probation or parole conditions.
And what are you treating?
Well, we treat the sexual offense behavior specifically, but we also treat more broadly the emotional health of the individual. The people that come to us have pervasive challenges in part because they're on the public registration website. They have trouble coming out of prison. Actually, there's a horrific problem right now about home plans. Recently, there were as many as 1,000 individuals who qualified for parole in our state prisons who were denied parole because they couldn't get a home plan approved. The longer sentences you have, the more removed you are from your family, the harder it is to find a place that will accept you to live. It's also hard to get a landlord to say yes if he checks the registry and your face is on the registry. So home plans are difficult. Employment's difficult. Employers are understandably reluctant to hire individuals with criminal histories to begin with, and sexual criminal histories in particular.
But something I wanted to get at is that I do think when somebody offends against a child as a sexual predator, we do assume that there is something inside of them, for lack of a better term, that has to be addressed or treated, that they will do that again because there is something inside that drives them to do so. Is that not what we as a society tend to think?
That is what society tends to think.
And is that not?
Well, it's true. It's true in some cases, but not in others. There's much more complexity to what goes into a sexual offense than merely a pathological compulsion to offend against children. You know, if you know one offender, you know one offender. And so it's important to do a very good evaluation and background and see what forces drove the behavior.
And let me ask you, Greg Rowe, to weigh in on that.
Sure. I want to back up 1 second on the recidivism discussion. 1 in 4 girls, 1 in 6 boys is sexually assaulted before the age of 18. Now, we heard from Captain Price earlier, we have a few thousand people on the sex offender registry. That's a small subset of the total number of represents a small number of the total victims of sexual assaults. So the studies that are out there capture that very small subset of A, cases that are reported, the smaller subset of cases that go to trial, and after that, the even smaller subset of cases that result in a guilty plea or a conviction. So I'm not here to scare anybody about sex offenders, but I get very nervous when those studies that report 15% recidivism rates are used because they don't accurately reflect the lack of reporting by victims. So I just wanted to make that point.
And I can agree with a large part of that because there's a lot we don't know. And in fact, my agency's helped confirm those statistics. We've done random digital surveys of adults in Philadelphia, and those numbers bear out. In fact, in Philadelphia, it's 1 in 3. And we do a lot of work with children and adults who've been victims of sexual abuse ourselves. And so we're very sensitive to the tragedy and the trauma of sexual abuse. But just to pick up on that point, when we make harsher registration and other laws around this, we actually have a negative impact on willingness to report crimes. Often there's not much separation between the offender and the victim. Yeah. They're in the same family, they're in relationships, and individuals are concerned they're becoming increasingly reluctant to report the offender.
That's not necessarily correct. The registry that's responsible for that. There are family dynamics that are responsible. We've seen that up at Penn State with Sandusky. You oftentimes have a culture where it's very difficult. If you have a child who has been sexually assaulted by her mom's boyfriend, she may be reluctant, and this is not an uncommon situation. She may be reluctant to report it. In those cases, the registry has nothing to do with it because the person who has raped her isn't even on the registry in the first place. Another point is, I don't think the issues we've been talking about are mutually exclusive. In other words, treatment, particularly if a sex offender is in prison or under supervision, absolutely, absolutely. But I don't think that's a substitute for incarceration, and I don't think it's a substitute for notification to the community.
But, Greg, Ted said, when you know one offender, you know one offender. These registries, the law seems to suggest otherwise. It seems to suggest we do know something about these offenders, and that's why we want people to know about them.
But there is a delineation in the laws. For example, the laws do require assessments of sexual offenders to determine whether they are, quote, sexually violent predators. Really a fancy term for the worst of the worst.
And what are we looking for there?
And I think Ted and people
who
work for Ted do those.
Some of my staff do those.
Yes.
And we're looking for somebody who suffers from a mental abnormality such that they're likely to reoffend. And if they are found to be a sexually violent predator and the court upholds that finding, they have to be lifetime registrants. They have to quarterly verify their information for life. And they have to undergo monthly counseling, sex offender counseling. And if they don't, that's a first-degree misdemeanor, and they can be put back in prison. Their parole can be revoked, or there can be tougher sanctions against them. Moreover, look, not every crime that's out there is on the list of crimes. There are a lot of crimes there, but there are some crimes that aren't. So I think distinctions are made between the number of years that you're on there, the types of verification that's on there, the length of verification. That reflects that there are some differences. But look at it from a parent and a child point of view. Not every system is perfect. Not every law is perfect. I don't think any law is perfect. But if you have a system where you want to give the tool to the parent to be able to say, here's how you can protect yourself and really more important, your child, here are the crimes that we've determined are often of a sexual nature or of a child abuse nature that sometimes includes sexual activity, and here's a tool that you can use to protect yourself.
But one more question along those lines. What about other crimes? Why not arsonists? Why not violent muggers?
Well, but before we do that, okay. I'd like to respond to what Greg says. I'm a parent and a grandparent, and I certainly want to know who's living in my neighborhood and who's living in the neighborhood of my grandchildren. I want to respond to that with protective changes. However, when this has been looked at, people don't tend to look at the registry. And when they do look at the registry, they don't tend to change their behavior. So we have a very expensive process in place that gives us little bang for our buck. And we're ignoring the other things we need to do to actually protect children in terms of education, better policies and procedures in daycare centers and in schools and on and on. There's a lot we're not doing that would be more effective to protect children than the expense of the registry.
And I want to get to that, but I'll let you respond.
Again,
Greg Rowe.
I think in one sense we can do both. I think the fact that, and Ted's right, there's not enough education, there's not enough outreach and training. We can do that. We can also have the registry at the same time. I think the fact that some people aren't using the registry correctly doesn't mean that those people who do use it correctly shouldn't have access to it. So if there's something that comes out of this, perhaps it's how do we ensure that people are using the information correctly? I'm a parent of a small child. I go on the registry. Am I using it correctly? I don't know. I find it helpful. I know there are many other things I need to do to make sure my child doesn't become a victim. Sometimes that, I mean, that's obviously one of the worst things imaginable, to have a child who's a victim of sexual assault. But for me, it's something that is a useful tool. Again, I don't know if I'm doing it right or not, but I don't think we should punish those who are using it right and want to use it right, because there are some studies that say some people aren't using it in the best way possible.
But let me return to my other question, which was, why not arsonists? Why not muggers and robbers? And
a couple of things. Number one, look, in policy and legislation, you have to draw a line somewhere. It's all about line drawing. So, sure, you could have one, and there have been proposals for arsonists, for domestic abusers, for people who abuse animals. It costs money, and it takes up resources. I think with sexual offenders, because these crimes are so underreported, look, arsonists, you know, there's an arson, there's an investigation. Most arsons, you catch the person. A murderer, typically you catch the person. Somebody who commits aggravated assault, look, sometimes go unreported, but there's not systemic underreporting. With child sexual abuse and sexual abuse in general, we only know the tip of the iceberg. So it's helpful to, at least of those that we know, to provide that tool, because you can take steps to protect yourselves and your children from somebody who's a rapist or committed a sexual assault in the past.
And we're coming up toward a break, but let me bring up something that Ted Glackman has mentioned, which is, won't these registries prevent some people from reporting sexual crimes? Because now, it's on some level, it feels like you're handing down a life sentence.
That's a fair point, and that's always the challenge. And everything is always a balance.
But it goes beyond that, because the judicial system also has there are forces in play that also reduce convictions of sexual offense. There's a study that came out of South Carolina looking at their registry laws, and there, what's emerged are disincentives to plea bargain. And so more cases go to trial, and DAs and judges who don't like this law will find ways to circumvent prosecution and conviction. And so there's evidence that the number of successfully prosecuted cases is decreasing because of the response of the system.
Although our prosecutors do believe that this system in Pennsylvania does provide appropriate leverage in cases where you do need and want a plea bargain because the victim, for example, isn't going to testify, that there is the leverage to get that appropriate plea bargain even within the system. It may make it more challenging, but this isn't sufficiently draconian or punitive to prevent that part of the process.
And Greg wrote, we're coming up on a break, but generally, are we safer with this new law in about 15 seconds?
It's a help. If it's continued to be used correctly, because it does close loopholes that have allowed – look, prior law, if you're an out-of-state sex offender moving to Pennsylvania, you didn't have to register. We fixed that. If you're a homeless sex offender, you didn't have to register. We fixed that.
All right. That is Greg Rowe. He is chief of the Legislation and Policy Unit for the Philadelphia District Attorney's Office. Also talking with Ted Glackman of the Joseph J. Peters Institute. We're talking about sex offender registries, and we'll be right back after a short break and also take some phone calls. So do stay with us.
Folkways at Gwynedd supports WHYY. Guided by time-honored Quaker values, Folkways is a continuing care retirement community for adults 65 and over. Since 1967, Folkways has been providing its residents with a comprehensive health program and financial stability. Folkways is committed to friendship, caring, and respect as a way of life. For more information or a personal tour, the number is 215-283-7010.
And as long as I got my suit and tie.
On the next Fresh Air, an interview with Justin Timberlake. He's just released his first new album since 2006. And Nathan Englander talks about his new translation of the Passover Haggadah and his latest collection of short stories, What We Talk About When We Talk About Anne Frank, which is out in paperback. Join us. Let me show
you a few. This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Mm-hmm. I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. As the Supreme Court takes up same-sex marriage, what effect do the laws banning marriage have on same-sex marriage divorces? Also, the view of the war in Iraq from a soldier who served three tours and now teaches and lives there. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mike and Scott in for Marty Moscowane. We're talking about sex offender registries and Pennsylvania's new stricter Megan's Law, which is now compliant with the Adam Walsh Child Protection and Safety Act. Joining us are Ted Glackman. He's with the Joseph J. Peters Institute, which provides counseling and treatment for sex offenders as well as the victims of sexual abuse. And also with us is Greg Rowe. He's chief of the Legislation and Policy Unit for the Philadelphia District Attorney's Office. And said we were going to take some phone calls at 1-888-477-9499. So let's have Lynn join us. She's from Morrisville, Pennsylvania. Hi, Lynn. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. How are you today?
Good. Thank you. Go ahead.
I'm currently registered under Megan's Law. I was an out-of-state offender. I came into the state. I registered as I was supposed to. And I currently have a 5-year-old daughter. My case was in New Jersey. It was under, I was convicted 4 years before Megan's Law even came into effect. And I'm wondering what this new law has to do, how it will affect my family. My cousin is currently a Iraqi war veteran. It's been 20 years since my conviction, over 10 years since I've been released. Actually, close to 13 years since I've been released now. And I'm wondering what this has to do with me. What, since I'm required by law now to register every 3 months. I registered once a year prior to this.
Is there a resource? Lynn, I don't want to discuss the particulars of your case on the air and don't want to ask you any details. So is there a place where people can check in to find out how this will affect them?
I think the best source is the Pennsylvania State Police. They do run the registry, and they do, when somebody is non-compliant, they send out the notices, and they can provide, at least the law and the factual information. I mean, obviously, a defense attorney can give that information as well.
And Lynn, are you still with us?
Yes, I am.
Okay, let me ask you, so do call the state police. They should know exactly how this will affect you, if at all. But let me ask you, how has the registry affected your life otherwise in previous years?
I've had to start my own business since I couldn't get hired by anybody else. I became a courier, taking legal documents, which is rather ironic, and court documents, which is rather ironic, from one courthouse to another or one attorney's office to another. So I literally had to start my own business.
And what about the life of your child? Does this come up?
It's very difficult. Her cousins have brought it up to her, and she's a 5-year-old, so she doesn't understand these things.
All right. Lynn, thank you so much. I'm sorry.
It's just a very difficult situation to be in.
Yeah. Lynn, I want to thank you for your call to Radio Times, and I want to turn to Ted Glackman. You alluded earlier to the effect of registries and now stricter registries on the lives of offenders. What does it do to their ability to rehabilitate?
Well, yeah, let me say first off that we want these individuals, men and women, to be successful. The community is protected better when these people have successful reentry into the community and have more successful lives. But with the registry and the other laws around sexual offenses, we've created numerous barriers to having healthy, successful lives. As indicated before, housing is difficult. Those who work do tend to work in self-employment circumstances. If there's a relative or somebody they're close to has a business, sometimes they could get employed there. I know a couple guys who worked as bartenders. working construction, working off the books in restaurants or landscaping is not uncommon. So it's hard to put together employment to begin with, and then there's limitations to the things you can do unless you have connections or unless you're not entrepreneurial and can work for yourself.
And do people have ongoing treatment?
Typically, it's a condition of probation or parole that as long as they're on probation or parole, or as Greg said, if they're a sexually violent predator, they have lifetime monthly treatment. But usually there's at least weekly group treatment that's in place for these individuals.
And what does that look like? Is it talk therapy? What do we know about what works?
In the last 20 years, the field has moved towards cognitive behavioral approaches that look at thinking, thought patterns. Of course, we're interested in sexual histories because there's often a close relationship between events earlier in life and later behavior. But the dominant approach is a cognitive behavioral approach. More recently, motivational interviewing is used a lot. And I think the field has shifted away from a previous position of shame and blame to more positive approaches to help individuals look at what they did, take responsibility for their behavior, but also to build a healthier life to reduce recidivism.
And is it to reduce, to deal with triggers, to offend? What exactly is the it you're trying to address in treatment?
To me, and I think at my agency, it's to build a good life is the overarching goal. A good life means lower recidivism. Within that, absolutely, what conditions are more conducive to impulsive or incorrect behavior? What kind of thinking allows people to hurt other people, essentially? Those are the things we drill down on.
Greg, did you want to weigh in on that?
Sure. To kind of circle back here, what I think we can't lose sight of is that there is a problem of sexual assaults in our community. I mean, consider that child pornography is becoming more and more rampant in the age of the internet. And in fact, 1 in 6 cases of child pornography reveals actual physical contact with a child. There's been a 65% increase.
We need another show for that.
In enhancements. Mm-hmm. According to the U.S. Sentencing Commission. And I say that because there are defendants, convicted defendants out there who do awful things to adults and to children. And even people who peddle in child pornography are capable and sometimes do more than just look at pictures. There was a brilliant piece in the New York Times Magazine a few weeks ago by Emily Bazelon that talked about the re-victimization effect of victims of child pornography every time they know that someone new is looking at a picture of them when they were a child. And the picture isn't just them without clothes. It's typically having to have performed a sexual act. Tip of the iceberg. Most of these cases aren't reported. So as citizens here, there is great utility to knowing that which is out there, which is unfortunately the minority of cases since most cases aren't reported. And while I understand it is difficult to reintegrate into the community, and God bless Ted for trying to do that, and we need more of it because jobs is important and housing is important, there is a balance as well, and there has to be a balance of what helps the child and what helps the parent protect the child. So I don't mean to be a sort of a caca optimist here, but I think we can have it both ways, and one isn't mutually exclusive to the other.
How would it look in an ideal world, in your mind, Greg?
Sure.
Because I'm thinking in our society, a child sexual offender is the lowest of the low, mm-hmm. is lower than a murderer, is lower than anybody who's done anything, pretty much. So how would rehabilitation or life look after an offense?
Let me actually take a step back for a second. If there was one thing we could do to help, because all of us here, our goal here is to stop recidivism and to protect the children. If there was one thing we could do here, it would be to stop sexual offenses before they occur. And if we could promote for example, our child advocacy centers, our Philadelphia Children's Alliance, which provide multidisciplinary services to children, including forensic interviews, so the child sexual abuse victim is only interviewed once and not 3, 4, or 5 times, so much so that the chairman of a recent task force, the DA of Bucks County, had said, if there had been one of these centers in Center County, Jerry Sandusky would have been caught long before he raped more victims. Ideally, that's a way we can stop and have fewer people on the registry because we're providing the services to the children before this stuff happens even more. I think that's where the focus needs to be in our legislature on the national, state, and local level.
And Ted, let me ask you the same question. What can rehabilitation look like? Do people tend to not disclose their past as much as possible?
Well, the children's advocacy centers are absolutely critical, and we need to put more resources into those programs and do that work better and better. But when they get involved, a crime's already occurred. And so more needs to be done in community prevention in terms of making sure that those that care for children in particular know what child sexual abuse is and what it's not, and that they respond quickly and appropriately when there is cause for concern. I don't think that's done as well as we need to do it. So even before a child hits the advocacy center, much more work needs to be done in our families and in our institutions. And again, back to your question.
The rehabilitation. So, you know what? Let's actually fit a call in because we have Isaiah Thompson, I'm seeing here on the line, who is a reporter who covered extensively the lives of sex offenders who are on these registries. Isaiah, hi. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. Thanks for having me on the phone here.
Sure. We don't have much time left, but give us kind of a thumbnail sketch of what you found when you reported on this.
Sure. Yeah, I'll make it quick. Briefly, when I was a reporter, my first reporting job at the Miami New Times in Miami, Florida, I came across what I would call a cautionary tale of sex offender, especially residency restrictions. I found out that because of a new law that barred sex offenders from living 2,500 feet from all sorts of stuff, schools, playgrounds, the state had wound up sending them to live under this bridge. And when I broke my first story, they responded by moving them to another bridge. And it turned into this colony of like 100, just under 100 people, I think, at its height. And it was just a really crazy situation that didn't seem to be helping anybody involved. I did a piece for This American Life that you can hear about it if you want to.
So it basically had created a colony of outlaws, so to speak, who were all living in the same...
I don't know about outlaws.
Right,
I mean, they were out of prison, right? But,
right.
There was nowhere for them to live, and so they wound up under this bridge.
Yeah.
And I don't know that it was helping anybody. So I just see that as kind of a cautionary tale of, like unintended consequences, I guess,
yeah.
when these restrictions get too large.
All right, Isaiah, thank you so much. Let me give our guests time to respond. Greg, how about you go
thank
first?
You.
Sure.
Thank you.
We don't have that in Pennsylvania, residency restrictions. I think in Allegheny County, on a local level, they had that. It was struck by the courts. There is no state statute that addresses the broad residency restriction requirements for very much the reasons that Isaiah mentioned, that it's not great for public
right.
safety. You're driving. Megan's Law is to know where rapists and sexual offenders are. Residency restrictions drive them underground.
Yeah.
So they're antithetical to
but
each other.
If we take the image of living under a bridge, are they living under that bridge in the metaphorical sense of the description we just heard from Isaiah, Ted?
Well, in other ways, there are. And even though we don't have some of the residency restrictions that were in place, they get struck down by the Pennsylvania Supreme Court. We're not free from the prospect of those coming back on a statewide basis or in municipalities. In Georgia, a similar thing happened. Instead of under the bridge, they were in the woods. So those occur. But even without residence restrictions in place, parole and probation entities can still institute residency restrictions for people on parole or probation. And so we still have instances where individuals who are under supervision are told they cannot live within 1,000 feet of a daycare center, bus stop, whatnot. People have lost houses because a bus stop has changed. And what wasn't 1,000 feet away now is they need to move.
Yeah. But let me ask you, I asked you earlier, what would rehabilitation look like in an ideal world? So tell me.
Well, I think one thing that we haven't touched on is really risk assessment.
Mm-hmm.
Within a offense category, there's a wide range of risk. The offense category doesn't necessarily indicate how severe either the pathology is or the task of rehabilitation might be. And so I'm concerned that we're overreaching and we're flushing away lots of lives of individuals who could live very successfully in the community with the right supports and supervision by taking this more draconian approach.
And the supports would be
what? The supports would be access to treatment, access to therapy, individual as well as group, medication where it's needed. You know, in some counties, there's currently even some discussion about whether it's appropriate to use public funds, for instance, when an individual is eligible for medical assistance due to a disabling condition, should they be able to access sex offender specific treatment because of that? And so those discussions are complicated and difficult. So beyond for the most severe offenders, there are evidence-based programs like Circles of Support and Accountability, which have taken people at high risk, used faith-based organizations to surround them with a case management team 24/7, and those outcomes are very positive.
Mm-hmm.
So even with severe cases, we can be successful.
And Greg, any last words in about 30 seconds?
When a sex offender, even under treatment, relapses, there's a devastated victim in his or her wake.
Yeah. Yeah. And I want to thank you both for joining us on Radio Times. I know it's a difficult topic and a difficult conversation, so I'm glad you were here to have it with us. Greg Rowe is chief of the Legislation and Policy Unit for the Philadelphia District Attorney's Office, and Ted Glackman is with the Joseph J. Peters Institute. And I want to thank you both so much for joining us, and also want to thank our callers for calling in. I'm Mike and Scott, in for Marty Moskowain, and you've been listening to Radio Times.